How did I get here?
I am aware that all of my books, no matter how realistic they may be, contain a hidden message.
It's 1941. Franz Werfel is speaking on NBC's I'm an American. He's a child of old Europe, exiled to the New World, a celebrated writer starting again as a refugee at the age of 51.
All great writers have touched the wounds of their contemporary world. Yes, even to the extent of reopening those wounds.
Werfel's epic novel, The 40 Days of Musa Dagh, reopens a great wound from the First World War, the Ottoman Empire's attempt to annihilate its Armenian citizens. Since its first publication in 1933, it's been both banned and canonized, revered and reviled. But it's a book full of life, not death, as warm and expansive as its opera-loving, chain-smoking, voluble author himself. It tells the true story of a few thousand Armenian villagers who resisted Ottoman forces on Musa Dagh.
Musa Dagh, Mountain of Moses. At its summit in the grey dawn light, a whole population set up its camp. The mountaintop, the windy air, the sea surge put such new life into this people that the toil of the night seemed dispersed and forgotten. No more strained and exhausted faces, but only excited ones.
That book is still a great work of art. And for Armenians, for a very long time, it was the only thing that anyone knew about the Armenian Genocide out of the memories and the silences that governed the Armenian community. I was born of Armenian parents in Philadelphia. Almost every Armenian young person was asked if he had read, and so I thought I better get to know this novel. And I was very taken by it as a young man. But it was actually my first introduction to the genocide of the Armenians.
Ronald Grigor Suni is Distinguished University Professor of History at the University of Michigan.
Armenians understand what Milan Kundera once said about other small nations, that small peoples can disappear and they know it. And so for Armenians, this is a sign of recognition that we existed and we continue to exist and this is what happened to us.
How did I get here?
The 40 Days of Musa Dagh isn't much read anymore. It is, after all, more than 800 pages long. It's a book you can get lost in for weeks, teeming with characters like Krikor the apothecary, who knows the export figures for camel dung and the secret recipe for attar of roses, or Sarkis the deserter from the Russian front, his soul scooped out by war, or Nunik the ragged cemetery crone who sees the villagers both into and out of this world. The fictional leader of this motley crew is Gabriel Bagradyan, an Armenian of the diaspora who returns to save his people and finally, spoiler alert, makes the ultimate sacrifice.
How did I get here?
Gabriel Bagradyan spoke these solitary words without knowing it. Nor did they frame a question, but something indefinite, a kind of ceremonious amazement. The clear glitter of this Sunday in March may have inspired it, in this Syrian spring which shepherded flocks of giant anemones down along the flanks of Musa Dagh and out across the irregular plain of Antioch. A golden, invisible humming seemed to have encased the mountain.
Have you been to Musa Dagh?
I'm planning to go this summer.
Are you?
Yes.
That will be quite a journey for you.
It's not journey, it's pilgrimage.
Pilgrimage.
Pilgrimage for me.
Yeah.
Bishop Hovakim Manukyan is the primate of the Armenian Apostolic Church in Britain. Musa Dagh is a real mountain near the Gulf of Alexandretta in southwestern Turkey. Of the seven villages nestled in its foothills, only one is still Armenian. For the scattered descendants of those who had to leave, it remains a lost paradise, a place of dreams.
I go to my home. Yeah. I haven't been there. I'm 42 years old. I haven't been my home. And it's my home.
You still feel that's your
yes,
home?
Yes, it is. I still my home. It's in our blood.
If there's such a thing as an ancestral memory, I felt it. It was like I've smelled this before. It was like a combination of orange blossom and bay leaves, sea air, and that universal village smell of cow dung. And it was all of that mixed together, and I swear I knew that smell.
Nairi Abrahamyan was born in Toronto. Her father's parents came from Musa Dagh.
In all the stories that we hear, it's always a place that existed in the past. It's almost like this mythical place. But it's very much a place that exists today and that's just like, you know, a plane ride away that's living and breathing and, of course, changed. But it's still there.
The bees sucked from the innermost essence of Musa Dagh, from its magic dower, which set it apart from all the other melancholy peaks in the land, the flower-strewn meadows of its eastern slopes, the vineyards and apricot and orange orchards in a garden around its feet. All this seemed scarcely touched by the fall of man, under which, in rocky melancholy, the rest of Asia Minor mourns.
For all his detailed research into the topography, customs and daily weather conditions on the slopes of Musa Dagh that summer of 1915, Werfel's mountain flowers have the whiff of hothouse blooms in the great villas of old Vienna.
I was born in the beautiful city of Prague, but I have spent most of my life in Vienna. Vienna was a gay, bubbling fountain of music. The great opera, the famed orchestras, the classical theaters, with their ancient tradition, these were the focus of public life.
We're now at the corner of the Herrengasse. Now, this is really Werfel's haunt, because the two cafes where he basically, let's almost say, lived were the Herrenhof, which has disappeared, and the Café Central, which has become a tourist trap. He spends his whole days and sometimes into the night.
Franz Werfel's biographer, Peter Stefan Jung, lived with his subject so intensely that he began to have conversations with him in his dreams.
Can you describe him as you dreamt him?
If I remember correctly, he was rather short. A very happy, smiling character. When he spoke, it was more singing than speaking. To be in a room with him, even in the cafe, he would stand up and talk for hours, and people were mesmerized. Nobody spoke as long as he spoke.
Whoever cheats his readers of the truth serves not the spirit but his own bank account.
He was a genius. Let's put it that simply. He was a genius.
Not a modernist at all.
At all. I think if you would have told him, Mr. Werfel, are you a modernist? He would have laughed at you. After World War II, his name almost disappeared just after his death. I mean, don't forget that he was one of the biggest bestsellers between the two world wars. And then, I don't know what happens with fame, it faded tremendously quickly.
Why, do you think?
I believe because of his slightly old-fashioned style. I mean, my favorite novel, The 40 Days of Musa Dagh, does have this very thin layer of dust on it when you start reading. It's only after 30 pages that you take a deep breath and you get rid of that covering with
patina,
dust,
yeah.
And then it suddenly becomes an amazing world that opens.
As Gabriel scanned his people, his own people, a sudden horror began to invade him. So alien, so uncanny was the sight. Their masked faces looked like shriveled fruits. Women with silk headscarves, strings of coins around their necks, and clattering bracelets on their wrists. Men in dark robes, on their bearded heads, fezes or fur caps. Gabriel passed an ice-cold hand down the English cloth of his jacket. Why me, of all people? How shall I speak to them?
Gabriel Bagradian, the Armenian from Europe, is both drawn to and repelled by the Armenian villages. He stands in many ways for Franz Werfel himself, a Bohemian Jewish writer in Catholic Vienna, ambivalent, perplexed, disturbed by the village Jews who'd sought refuge there from the shtetls in the east.
We can have all these different beliefs in one person. He's very conservative and he's an anarchist. I mean, that makes no obvious sense, but he has all these tendencies within his huge heart and mind. But he, in 1918, is on the barricades here in Vienna during the revolution.
The Vienna Werfel arrives in near the end of the Great War to work in the Army Press Bureau is no longer an imperial capital. It's a war-scarred city that's lost its identity and its hinterland, fractious, politically febrile. But it's still the great centre of German culture. In its cafes, Werfel argues about art and politics. At the opera, he indulges his grand passion for Verdi, the subject of his first novel. And then something happens that will shape the rest of his life.
In 1918, he meets Alma Mahler. And that is the moment in his life that changes everything. Of course, she was 11 years his senior, but there was such an amazing energy coming from this woman. He wouldn't even have thought of going anywhere else after that first encounter, which lasted for the rest of his life.
The legendary Alma Mahler, talented composer, widow of Gustav, lover of Oskar Kokoschka, wife of Walter Gropius, wrote this setting of Werfel's poem, The Seer, 2 years before she met him. He became her third and final husband. Her granddaughter, Marina Mahler, remembers.
My mother was always very angry with her because she said she treated Werfel so badly. My mother thought that perhaps it was the greatest love of her life in the end because it was like her child. But one thing that bound them, they would play and sing together, Verdi and every possible thing, because he was a wonderful musician. And when they met, he was a poet, of course. She pushed him to write. I don't even remember working it out, but I kept hearing so much about her from my mother. She used to call her my tiger mama. She wasn't really a grandmother, you see. There was a little girl who, when she came to visit us, who afterwards came over and said, my granny is just a granny.
The loveliest girl in Vienna was Alma, the smartest as well.
And she had very pale skin, sort of luminous, I would say.
She seemed to really live by supporting and encouraging these great men who loved her and who she was in love with. Just my sense is that
she didn't decide upon it.
Right.
Mentally, no. She wanted herself to be a composer.
Yes.
She was steeped in painting and philosophy and literature all the time she was growing up. It was part of her. And therefore, I think it was a natural thing for her to meet love and be loved back. That was her ambiance. That was Vienna at the time.
Everybody went through Alma's apartment, let's put it that way. There was an immediate flow of high-tension, extreme energy happening between the two. Although in her journal she notes that this ugly little Jew came to her apartment and he's flat-footed, flat-lipped, the typical anti-Semitic remarks. But then, with all her anti-Semitism, she madly fell in love with this man. And he must have been a good lover, too, because she knew who she was choosing.
All his life, Werfel struggled with his Jewish identity. Given a Jewish education by his family, he was also taken to Mass by his Catholic nanny and deeply drawn to the church's pageantry and grandeur. He fell out with his friend Max Brot over Zionism and dreamed of a synthesis of the two great religions. Alma, openly anti-Semitic, despite her two Jewish husbands, was a constant provocation.
23 years of Europe. Paris. Years of complete assimilation. This marriage had worked a profound change in him. The Frenchwoman had drawn him her way. But even if he did not live in his father's land, he could not renounce it. These fathers had suffered in it monstrously and still not given it up. Gabriel had never suffered. Massacre and torture, he only knew through books and stories.
That parallel with the world of Central and Eastern European Jewry, to me, is absolutely central in the book.
Historian John Horn of Trinity College Dublin.
Gabriel Bagradian, Western, he's sophisticated, both part of the diaspora, but he discovers he's also part of the homeland. It's a wonderful device because it allows an educated Western audience in the 1930s to relate to the Armenians. So that very attractive figure with his French wife is there at the heart of the novel.
Werfel and Alma lived the life of the European haute bourgeoisie, moving between their various houses, travelling in style. In 1925, they made their first trip to Palestine, where Alma was appalled by the squalor, and Werfel began to rediscover his Jewish roots. He relearned Hebrew, pored over the Talmud, wrote an unfinished play called Paul Among the Jews. 5 years later, when they returned to the Holy Land, he was reconsidering his opposition to Zionism. And then, from Jerusalem, they travelled further east.
It was a hot day. We breathed easier when we got to Damascus. Our guide led us through some magnificent old mosques. But there, everything smelled of mortality.
Marina Mahler reads from her grandmother's memoir, And the Bridge's Love.
He took us to sumptuous bazaars and finally to the largest carpet-weaving plant, where the owner appeared and conducted a personal tour of his establishment for our benefit. In passing the rows of looms, we saw emaciated children with El Greco faces and enormous eyes. "What strange children are these?" Franz Werfel asked the owner. "Those poor creatures? I pick them up in the street and give them 10 piastres a day, so they won't starve. They're the children of the Armenians killed off by the Turks."
And he asks, what's the matter with these young people? And finds out they're the survivors of the Armenian genocide, whose parents have perished. And they were babies when they were sort of saved, but they've not really recovered from the horrors. And then he wants to know more and more than he remembers, of course, that he knew about the whole story that had happened to the Armenians when he was in the press bureau. So he puts one and one together and says, I have to tell the story, I have to find out more.
I think it's really significant that the first major novel about the Armenian genocide, the Armenian catastrophe, is not written by an Armenian.
Thomas de Waal, author of The Great Catastrophe.
This was a period of trauma and of silence in which the Armenians were still coming to terms with what had happened to them, and it took an outsider to be able to kind of articulate the scale and the horror of what had happened.
The memory survived, of course. Armenian soprano Zabel Panossian, taken to America as a child in 1896, sings of a migrating bird in this recording from 1917. Crane, have you no news from our country? During the Great War, the fate of the Armenians had sparked both a powerful humanitarian outcry and a propaganda effort by the Entente powers against Germany and its Ottoman ally. Newspapers published cartoons of the bloodthirsty Turk and his brutal German overlord. Werfel also fell into Orientalist stereotypes of barbarous, bestial Muslims and childlike Armenian Christians looking to the West for their salvation. John Horn gives the historical background to the Ottoman Empire's escalating campaign of destruction.
In the last part of the 19th century, what had been a multi-ethnic empire was beginning to recast its language and its organisation of politics in terms of nationality. And when the Young Turks come to power in their revolution of 1908, they see themselves as modernisers for a modern Ottoman Empire which will accommodate most of the peoples there, including the Armenians. And the particular shock, I think, is that of the two Balkan Wars in 1912 and 1913, in which the Ottoman Empire is really ejected from almost the last of its holdings in the Balkans. There's a flood of refugees back, and many, crucially, many of the Young Turk leadership, they're European Turks, they're angry, they're humiliated, and they have a project for the regeneration of the Ottoman Empire as a more Turkic entity. And it's really with that in mind that they enter the First World War on the side of Germany and Austria-Hungary. And once they've done that, then the whole dynamic of mobilizing for war, fighting a war on multiple fronts, kicks in and begins to have a devastating impact on the interplay between the different national components of the Ottoman Empire.
By the time the Werfels visited that Damascus carpet factory, a silence had long since descended over the fate of the Armenians across most of the West. The Young Turkish Republic was becoming a strategic ally, and the great catastrophe an inconvenient truth.
He came back from that trip, and then very quickly he understood that there was an Armenian community in Vienna who had their own monastery. And he asked, do you have a library? And he found out that they have a huge library. And they opened all their doors, and he did research for months.
Werfel immersed himself in the eyewitness accounts of the German pastor Johannes Lepsius, who had frequently raised the alarm at home on behalf of the Armenians. And he read the testimony of Father Dikran Andreasian, deported from the eastern Anatolian town of Zeytun, who escaped a death march to warn the villagers of Musa Dagh. Both men became major characters in his book.
Phase one is the reaction to the defeat of the Ottoman Third Army in eastern Anatolia, the late winter 14 to 15. As the Ottoman troops are withdrawing, they start massacring, accusing the Armenians in villages and towns of rising against them. Stage two, late March and April, in certain towns, Zeytun, which Werfel talks about, more systematic massacres occur, agreed on by the regime, but undertaken very much on the initiative of the local governors.
The town emptied from day to day. The roads to Marash filled with long human snakes, whose marchers seemed unable to advance. A watcher from the town of Zeytun might have seen the convoys far into the mountains, and nothing could have aroused more horror in him
than the creeping quiet of these lines of death, rendered more piteous still by the shouts and laughter of the armed escort. Carpets, clothes, bedsteads, heaps of linen, furniture, mirrors were all piled up in leisurely, undisturbed tranquility, as though it were an ordinary, lawful house moving. The authorities did nothing to prevent it.
Ja, wir sind Peter Jung und die Leute vom BBC. Der Pater Paulus erwartet uns. Achso, Sie wissen.
Back in the safety of the present, Father Paulus welcomes us into the monastery's parlor, a comfortable faded room where we're warmed by a blazing wood stove and sweet Mekaterina liqueur.
What do we say in Armenian?
Genats.
Yeah. Genats. Yeah. From where originally your family?
From Musadagh.
You are also Musadaghci.
I'm Musadaghci.
You
yes.
are Musadaghci. I'm so pleased.
I'm born in Heidelberg.
In Heidelberg.
1938.
Have you been back there since then?
Yes, 1975.
And so, have you read The 40 Days of Musadaghci?
Yes, yes. Franz Werfel ist ein guter Freund der Armenien, das kennt jeder.
So, we're in this place with you, born in Musadagh, part of the real history of Musadagh, and where Werfel came to read the testimony of Father Lepsius
yes.
and Father Andreasian in your library.
Yes. Franz Werfel hat den Roman geschrieben, auch für die Juden, für sein Volk. Und das Held des Romans, Gabriel Bagradian. Warum heißt Bagradian?
Pater Paulus says that the story actually has a lot to do also, of course, with the Jewish people.
Also for his people.
Also.
Only.
No, of course not only. But also knowing that the Jewish people at that time were in danger.
The authorities had sent a handful of men to clear a considerable district. The Armenian sheep would be certain not to put up a fight when led to the slaughter. How could a weak race of shopkeepers stand up to a nation of soldiers?
On the 24th of April 1915, as the Allied invasion of Gallipoli becomes imminent, leading intellectuals and churchmen from the Armenian community in Constantinople are rounded up. A clear decision is taken that the elites should be eliminated.
Perhaps, for the space of half a second, the chief of police felt the insecurity of a barbarian confronted with a superior civilization. But then he boiled with redoubled hatred, remembering Talat Bey's famous words, quoted again as they mustered to set out, "Either they disappear or us."
By June, the order is given for widespread deportations of the entire populations of Armenians sent to the desert. At the same time, because there is the imagined mythical fear that the Armenian masculine population, the teenagers, the adults, are going to rise up in the rear of the Ottoman army, they start massacring males over the age of 12.
The old sporadic fanaticism of religious hatred had been skillfully perverted into the cold, steady fanaticism of national hate.
This is something which isn't just a matter of orders. There is a regime behind it to carry it out. That's to say, the civil administration, there are militarized gendarmes, there is the army itself, and the special organization for eliminating the enemy within. By 1916, the vast bulk of Armenians in the Ottoman Empire have been either massacred or deported to the desert, wherein they're in the process of dying.
There's one quote from the book where he describes the Armenians being taken to slaughter. They're not human beings anymore. They're ghosts, ghosts of apes. They die only very slowly because they eat grass. But the worst of all is that they don't have any strength anymore to bury their 10,000s of dead. Der is Zor, that is an immense cesspit of death. I mean, this is the description of Auschwitz.
In the novel, though, he doesn't dwell very much on the genocide itself. It's really a book about resistance.
You mean that you have to fight back? At least there is a chance to do something if you
yes.
gather and if you decide this cannot happen.
It's about hope.
He, Bagradian, also wanted resistance. To the last drop of their blood. He pointed in the direction of Musadagh, whose peaks towering behind the roof seemed to look down and take part in the great assembly. They probably all remembered the old stories in which the Damlaik had offered help and protection to escaping Armenians.
With their bundles, their goats and their pack mules, about 1,000 families climbed the Damlaik, the rocky heart of Musadagh.
My father was 15 years old in the time, and he had the fighters to bring the food, and so my mother was about 10 years.
Did your parents tell you stories of that time on the mountain?
My mother told me something.
The women stumbled under loads which bowed them almost to earth. And yet, now and again, under these burdens, there came a little spurt of young girls' laughter, an eye sparkling encouragement. The last group had plodded its way past. They're all up there now, reflected Gabriel. A faint wind rose toward the cosmos.
Die Mutter mit drei Kindern ging auf den Berg.
His grandmother, the mother of his mother, had three children and took them to the mountain with her, but she could only carry two. So there was the baby, the smallest one.
Meine Mutter, die älter war, hat geweint.
Jetzt verstehe. So that's a crazy story. His mother was one of those three children. And the mother of the mother said, we have to leave the baby behind. I can't carry all three of you. And then his mother was so shocked and so sad and started crying so badly and said, we can't do that, we can't do that. And then they took the baby too. So she saved her sister.
These stories have been handed down through scattered generations of Musadagh descendants. Historian Vahram Shemasyan lives in Glendale, California.
In mid-September of each year, the Armenians of Musadagh celebrated, they still do around the world, wherever Musadagh Armenians are found, their heroic feat of 1915.
Musadagians, they're like mountaineers, they had nothing to do with outside work.
Jean Abrahamian in Toronto, Canada.
What I studied, what I was told by my grandfather or other babugs, that it was like an army discipline. They had so-called doctors to look after the wounded. They had people to look after food.
I used to listen as a young boy, those rough, tough Highlanders sitting there with their special hats and cussing sometimes and barbecuing shish kebab.
Can you remember how they talked about it?
Usually they describe how they pulled the trigger, how the enemy soldier was killed, how some of them comrades were killed, not too many.
And how long were they there, in fact?
56 days.
Right.
40 days is symbolic. We do our weddings 40 days.
And they knew the topography like the palm of their hand, as we say. And they also, from the beginning, saw the sea as their conduit to salvation.
The great Jeanne d'Arc was on the horizon with the English and French cruisers behind her. When the squadron had anchored in perfect symmetry, there began a sparkling stir on the glassy sea. The squadron commander was himself most anxious to inspect this heroic encampment, where the offshoots of a Christian people had held their own for 40 days against a barbarically superior force. Bugle signals vied with one another. Chains and pulleys creaked. Slowly the big launches hovered down. The rescued people lay, sat, squatted on narrow ledges, and watched this sight through half-seeing eyes. Gabriel Bagradian had taken part in the destiny of his blood. He had led his native people in their struggle. His being here was no unlucky accident, but the deepest decision, not God's decision only, but his.
What's interesting is that it's a Moses figure. I'm quite sure that Werfel did this consciously, but Moses is also one who comes from the outside and then leads a people to their paradise in a certain way and to their identity, but coming from outside, and will not go and dies before they can go into their country, looking up from up high, from a mountain, over to the land of Israel, and he sees it, but he doesn't go there because he dies there. And the 40 is also, of course, a biblical number, as
yes,
we know.
Yes.
The 40 years that the Jews were in the desert.
I keep imagining Werfel dreaming of a long, narrow road. On one side, the stuccoed whipped cream buildings of old Vienna. On the other, dusty Armenian villages and the long lines of people walking to their deaths. In his mind, as if in a stereopticon, those images start to converge.
But that would mean that he was prescient in a certain way. But he would have never thought that it would go to this extreme,
right,
that the 20th century would have another genocide that would go far beyond what happened to the Armenians. I mean, that's unthinkable.
In November 1932, his novel still unfinished, he set out on a lecture tour. Historian Stefan Erich of the University of Haifa.
Franz Werfel was touring Germany in this fateful winter when basically the future of Germany was hanging in the balance, when it was clear that more conservative forces would perhaps hand over power to the Nazis.
Alma, of course, was with him.
He did not read as well as he usually did. I wondered whether his theatrical delivery might be my fault, because I judged him with too much loving blindness instead of criticizing at once.
He chose to read the fifth chapter of his work in progress, Interlude of the Gods, in which Pastor Lepsius visits Enver Pasha, one of the triumvirate ruling the Ottoman Empire, to plead for the Armenians. Werfel ramps up the tension as the two men skirmish, gradually abandoning their diplomatic finesse. He makes it very clear that his Enver also stands for figures closer to home.
He bent forward confidentially. Dr. Lepsius, let's suppose that Germany found herself with traitors in her midst. Alsace-Lorrainers, shall we say, or Poles, or Social Democrats, or Jews. Would you, Herr Lepsius, consider it so cruel if, for the sake of victory, all dangerous elements in the population were simply herded together and sent packing into a distant, uninhabited territory?
We know from articles on his readings that the atmosphere Werfel created must have been very intense. One reviewer writes that it feels like Johannes Lepsius is not so much addressing Enver Pasha, but actually speaking to the Germans in the room, but the German nation as a whole as well.
The Turkish population is 40 million. Well, now, try to see it from our point of view, Herr Lepsius. Is it not a great and worthy policy to try to weld these 40 millions together and establish a natural empire which henceforth will play the same part in Asia as Germany does in Europe? This empire is waiting. We have only to grasp it. Johannes Lepsius's voice became soft and surcharged with wisdom. But the corpse of the Armenian people will be beneath its foundations. Could no more peaceful way be chosen? Even now, here, for the first time, Enver Pasha laid bare his deepest truth. His smile had no longer any reserve in it. There can be no peace between human beings and plague germs.
Though the fate of the Armenians had been largely forgotten elsewhere, in Germany, allied with the Ottomans in the First World War, the issue had never gone away. Both during and after the war, left and right had argued about German complicity in the Armenian horrors. Stefan Erich.
There is this debate in the early 1920s about the Armenian genocide in Germany. On one level, it was about German complicity in what had happened. And on another level, it was also about the crime committed against the Armenians as such.
In 1921, in Berlin, an Armenian assassinated Talat Pasha, a key architect of the Armenian massacres, and was acquitted after a trial lasting only a day and a half. The trial sharpened an already polarized debate.
Some nationalist authors, they go from denialism to outright justifying the genocide, that the Armenians were treacherous, that there were parasites on the national body, racially predestined to profit of other people's work and culture and politics, perceived as tricky, treacherous, and so on. Authors of popular racial books wanted to see the Armenians as related to the Jews.
Adolf Hitler and the Nazis were not only aware of the Armenian genocide, but in some ways saw it, that is the ethnic cleansing, mass killing, deportation of a minority population in the Ottoman Empire, they saw that as a model for what they might want to do to cleanse and make ethnically and racially whole Germany and its colonies.
Ronald Grigorsuni. Hitler was touring Germany at the same time as Werfel. That December, their paths crossed in a Breslau hotel. Alma wanted to catch a glimpse of the rising political star.
At last, the waiter, whom I had previously bribed, came to fetch me, and I joined the crowd awaiting him. By then, Werfel was back from his lecture. Both of us felt that there must be something to a face that had enthralled 30 millions. Werfel stood behind me. The SS men, who suddenly lined the stairs, wanted to make me step down, but I promised to stand quietly behind one of them. Then I saw the face I had been waiting for. Clutching eyes, young, frightened features, no Duce, an adolescent, rather, who would never mature, would never achieve wisdom. When it was over, when Hitler had bounded up the stairs and vanished through an open door, I asked Werfel for his impression. He did not reply.
When Hitler was sworn in as Chancellor, Werfel struggled to go on writing his Musadach. Ought he to change the plot? More pressingly, he was asked to sign a declaration of loyalty to the newly Nazified Prussian Academy of Arts and Sciences.
After this enormous, tremendous work, which in letters he writes is the biggest, the most unbelievable work I've ever done in my life, he didn't want this to go to nowhere. Of course, in Austria, the book was able to be sold, but he wanted it to be sold in Germany to warn the Jews. So I think he signs this to save the book. It didn't help him.
But his earlier books are being burned in German towns before he finishes Musadach.
Correct. Unbelievable. I mean, what does that do to a writer? What does he feel? What does he think?
But he goes on and he finishes it, and it is published.
He fights in a certain way. The book is in the bookshops in Germany. The booksellers sold them all.
Until, that is, the Turkish Foreign Ministry heard of the publication and sent a chargé d'affaires to visit Joseph Goebbels. Within 3 days, the book was banned and confiscated. Goebbels, of course, needed little prompting to censor a Jewish author.
In Germany, I'm being deleted from the books of the living, and since I am in the end a German author, I am suspended in empty outer space.
But Musadach had already spread its wings beyond the Reich. Translated into many European languages, but not Turkish, that took another 60 years, it became an instant success in the United States, selling 34,000 copies in 2 weeks. MGM immediately snapped up the movie rights. Film historian David Welke.
Musadag in America was a smash hit, a critical darling, and it had a lot of popular appeal as well. And you know that MGM was excited about it because they were thinking of casting Clark Gable as the lead in this film. Turkey's ambassador to the United States, a man by the name of Mehmet Munir, issues a protest to the State Department, and it says in part, desist from presenting any such picture, which could only give a distorted version of the alleged massacres and would almost certainly stir up any anti-Turkish feeling in this country.
At that point, they say, we don't want Turkey's image to be destroyed, is the official way of presenting it.
Historian Fatme Müge Göcek.
But they think it would destabilize the whole state and delegitimate it.
The Board of Censors in Istanbul says that if MGM makes this film, we'll cut off MGM altogether. Parts of the Turkish press start to tie into some even uglier arguments. There's one Turkish newspaper that refers to Werfel as a shameless Jew, and that MGM is a Jewish-dominated corporation. Armenians in Turkey are quite concerned that if MGM goes ahead and makes this movie, that the Turks will lash out against them.
The State Department conveyed the Turkish ambassador's concerns to MGM. At the height of the Depression, the front office was worried about losing foreign revenues. The correspondence dragged on and on for years. No Hollywood film was ever made of Franz Werfel's novel. But the book took on another life in Nazi-occupied Europe.
After the meeting of the House Committee, the person in charge of book circulation hands over to the woman a package wrapped in a paper and whispers, "You've got to return it in 3 days. 20 people are waiting their turn. This is the real thing." 40 days of Musadag, This is the most popular novel among the adults in the ghetto. They'll read it aloud this evening, if there is electricity.
What we know now, that the 40 Day of Musadag with Tolstoy, War and Peace, was the most read books in the ghettos during the occupation of Poland by the Nazis.
Historian Yair Aharon, author of 100 Years of Musadag.
The book was translated in 1938 into Yiddish in Warsaw. And they asked themselves what to do. We have to resist. Don't go as a sheep to the slaughter. And the same dilemma, don't go to the sheep as a slaughter, appears several times in Musadag. In the General Assembly of the Armenian in Musadag, they discuss what to do, whether to resist till the last man or to give up. And they knew that if they are going to revolt, their end will be even closer. But they repeated, we have to resist.
For 4 full days, I was engrossed in the book and could not tear myself away. I myself was at Musadag. I was under siege. I was one of the Armenians doomed to death. If I lifted my eyes from the book, it was only to hear the cry, Mama, how could this be? The world knew and kept silent.
There was a debate in the ghetto of Bialystok in June 43, whether to stay in the ghetto or to go to the forest. And I remember one of them called Herschel. He said, we have nothing to do but to fight in the ghetto. The ghetto in Bialystok has to become our Musadag. If I can say, the story of Musadag is nice story with a nice happy end because they were saved, most of them. More than 4,000 Armenians from Musadag were saved. For the Jews, they knew that they are going to be killed, to be massacred.
Werfel managed to escape with Alma over the Pyrenees, on the route taken by so many of Europe's fleeing artists and intellectuals. History had overtaken his prophetic novel.
In our hands we carried the few indispensable possessions that remained to us. Before we attempted this dangerous flight over the mountains, I destroyed several manuscripts of my own writings so that if we were arrested, they would not fall into the hands of the Gestapo.
Franz Werfel died in August 1945, just before the war's end, with newsreels of the death camps rolling in the cinemas.
Epilogue. Diary, September 2nd. Why am I still alive? A week ago, I lost my sweet man-child. I still can't grasp it. I keep thinking he must come home from Santa Barbara. But he will never come home.
But where was home for this bohemian Flüchtling, citizen of a long-vanished empire torn apart by the nationalism that both drew him and appalled him?
We're standing in front of this granite, grey, blackish monument with golden letters. Franz Werfel, Prague, 1890 to 1945, Beverly Hills.
So this is the only monument to Werfel in Vienna, and it's put up not by the Austrians, but by the Armenians.
Below it says, in Dankbarkeit und Hochachtung das armenische Volk. In thankfulness and full of admiration, the Armenian people.
It's making him a national writer of the Armenians.
Absolutely. And has nothing to do with Austria.
Nothing.
How did I get here?
Werfel's true monument is made of paper and ink. It's here, in my hands. Or yours.